charged, never convicted. Dom and Groot are the Devil's Advocates.
Welcome back to the Devil's Advocates radio show. Dominic, we've been joined live via Zoom by a fine guest, a friend of ours. He is Brendan Fisher, Federal Reform Program Director with the Campaign Legal Center. Brendan, welcome back.
All right, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Brendan.
Brendan, appreciate you joining us. The topic, at least what we propose for a topic, is sort of the aftermath of the Capitol 6th insurrection, January 6th Capitol insurrection. And Brendan, initially it seemed like there'd be a lot of pushback, especially against those Republican U.S. senators that, despite the insurrection, still voted to not uphold the Electoral College victory for Joe Biden. And the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, well, they obviously, they lead industry and they collect money from industry and they give money for industry. And suddenly they're kind of backpedaling, and that's where you come in. Brendan, set the stage for the audience, if you'd be so kind.
Yeah. So, you know, as you mentioned, there were a number of politicians, both senators and members of the House of Representatives, who voted to, you know, reject the will of voters, to throw out people's votes, and to overturn the results of a fairly run election. And as a result of that, there were a number of, you know, pretty major companies that came out and said publicly that they are no longer going to financially support those politicians who, you know, effectively stoked the January 6th insurrection. There was a vast array of statements that were made. Some companies said outright that we are never going to support these particular pro-insurrectionist candidates again. Some companies said we are going to just simply pause our political giving and reassess the situation. But then the Chamber of Commerce just over the weekend came out and said publicly that they're not going to do anything. They're going to keep supporting the politicians that are going to push their agenda, regardless of whether those politicians, you know, support democracy or not. And a big part of the reason this matters is because, you know, the chamber does have a PAC. It makes contributions to candidates. It gave around $1 million in direct contributions to candidates in the 2020 election cycle. But where their real money comes from, where the real power comes from, is from their dark money political spending. They spent around $5 or $6 million in the 2020 election cycle, on top of millions and millions of dollars in dark money spent in prior years. And what this means is that those companies that say publicly that, you know, trust us, we support democracy, we're no longer going to support those insurrectionist politicians, could potentially secretly support those same politicians through the Chamber of Commerce, because any donation that these companies make to the Chamber of Commerce is not going to be publicly disclosed.
And Brendan, it seems as if they also somehow draw distinction between a simple no vote, a vote against the Electoral College outcome, a vote against democracy, you might say, and then ongoing actions. And I would wonder, a guy like Ron Johnson, he held hearings on voting irregularities, but that was prior to the Capitol insurrection. Is that the sort of actions that might disqualify one from the chamber's grandiose giving, or must it be post-insurrection?
Yeah, you would think that Ron Johnson would no longer get the chamber support. But, you know, I would suspect that what the chamber is doing is saying that, you know, we are going to give money to people who are going to advance our interests, because that's what they exist for, that they're a lobbying group. They're a corporate lobbying group that works to advance the interests of, you know, the biggest and most powerful corporations in America. And if their continued political giving and continued political spending is going to allow them to continue to advance the interests of their corporate backers, then they're going to do so.
Brendan, what about those that sort of actively incited? I realize not U.S. Senator, but Mo Brooks comes to mind. Guy that gave a speech at sort of the warm-up party to the insurrection. What's the chamber's attitude been about those that actively participated and maybe did a little inciting of their own?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think you'd have to ask the chamber about that one.
Folks, you're listening to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Brendan Fisher, Federal Reform Program Director at the Campaign Legal Center, joining us via the Zoom. Brendan, thank you for doing so. And I guess just as a note, you know, if the chamber's motivation to keep the trains running on time, then I can only understand that they'd probably give money to Mussolini then. I mean, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I think it will end up blowing back in their face, and I am very concerned about the dark money giving. I want to go on to another issue, Brendan, if we may. There's been a lot, now that we have this this particular bill, the American Repair Rescue Plan, has been now through the Senate and now goes back to the House. The Voting Rights Act, the AB1, there's been a lot of pushback in state government to try to reform perhaps even some of the own laws that Republicans themselves installed last election cycle. Then it didn't work for them, so now they want to repeal this and make it harder for people to engage. I know the Republicans are coming out very hard against this, Brendan. What are you and the Campaign Legal Center seeing on this front?
Yeah. So I think you're referring to HR1.
HR1, thank you.
The For the People Act, which passed the House last week. And it is it's a comprehensive democracy reform bill. HR1 would protect voting rights, end partisan gerrymandering, end dark money, and, you know, really restore the influence of voters over our democracy, rather than just the influence of wealthy special interests. And you've seen the politicians and the wealthy special interests that thrive in our money-drenched, broken political system lining up against this bill, because it is a substantial change, or if enacted, it would make substantial changes to the way our democracy operates, and that's a threat to a number of powerful politicians and powerful special interests. So the bill now moves on to the Senate, and, you know, it's going to be a challenge getting to 60 votes. But, you know, all hope is not lost. And as it begins to be considered in the Senate, I think we're going to see more opposition lining up to the bill and more misleading attacks on it, to be quite honest.
Brendan, I was going to ask you about McCain-Feingold. Perhaps this bill significantly more comprehensive in what it hopes to accomplish, but McCain-Feingold tried to rein in the campaign spending, and it was torn down effectively brick by brick through different legal rulings. Brendan, if they somehow can bring along some Republicans, pass this through the Senate, we know Pelosi's team has already passed it in the House. Brendan, can you envision this coming under immediate attack through the courts, be it First Amendment claims, et cetera?
Yeah, I think we'd almost certainly expect HR1 to be challenged in court if it were enacted. But that doesn't mean that those challenges would prevail. You know, just to take disclosure, which we were talking about earlier, as an example, you know, the Supreme Court decision in Citizens United did strike down a number of really important aspects of the McCain-Feingold law. But the court 8-1 upheld McCain-Feingold law's disclosure requirements, and the court endorsed transparency as a means of preventing and limiting the opportunities for corruption that arose from unlimited corporate spending in elections. It has not worked out that way. Disclosure has not worked out the way that the court predicted, in part because of outdated laws, in part because the Federal Election Commission has not enforced the laws that are on the books. But, you know, a big part of HR1 is to ensure the disclosure anticipated by Citizens United. So we would expect that the court would uphold HR1 disclosure provisions. And that's the same with many of the other provisions in HR1. You know, they're crafted to survive judicial review, you know, even the judicial review that we'd expect from a conservative dominated Supreme Court.
Now, Brendan, my understanding as well, this has, at least from the people, a fairly broad bipartisan support. Is that your understanding as well?
Yeah. I think polls overwhelmingly show that voters across the political spectrum support the For the People Act. You know, I think it's no surprise that both Republican and Democratic voters are fed up with the influence of wealthy special interests over our democracy, and they want a government that works for all of us instead of just a handful of corporate interests.
Now, Brendan, we talk all the time about people voting against their best interest. If this reins in the spending and perhaps sets new hurdles for the politicians, can we really expect them to vote outside of their quote unquote best interest? Might be in the best interest of democracy, but individually, many of them benefit certainly from incumbency and the money that flows to the incumbent.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's fair to say that there is no silver bullet to all of the problems all of the problems in the U.S. democracy and the U.S. political system. But certainly, money is a huge contributing factor to the problems with our democracy. The lack of access to voting is another contributing factor. And then partisan gerrymandering. Unrepresentative districts are also a major problem, contributing to the lack of fair representation in our democracy. And HR1 would address all of those things and address all of those things at once. It doesn't mean that the day after HR1 is signed into law that everything's going to be okay, but it would go a long way towards creating a more functional and representative democracy.
Our fine guest, Brendan Fisher, Federal Reform Program Director, Campaign Legal Center. Brendan, want to ask you about the gerrymandering specifically. Here in the state of Wisconsin, we often hear we got one of the most partisan gerrymanders in our nation's history. And we often look at the effect on state government because, of course, those that follow closely realize despite overwhelming Democratic support, sometimes we see more Republicans, especially in the Assembly and the Wisconsin State Senate. But this also affects more broadly the congressional seats. Here in the state of Wisconsin, we got like a coin flip electorate, and we've got 5 Republicans, 3 Democrats. Do you think with the recasting of the map, with or without the passage of HR1 through the Senate, do you think we will see an improvement in this gerrymandering?
Yeah, I mean, I know that is a ongoing battle in Wisconsin right now, and who ultimately is going to decide over what those maps look like is a topic of hot discussion, and the stakes are high. I think in Wisconsin, it definitely remains to be seen. If HR1 were enacted, what we would see are independent redistricting commissions. You'd have the lines drawn by, a nonpartisan body instead of drawn by, partisan elected officials like the Republican-controlled Wisconsin legislature.
And is it too much to think that we could get some bipartisan support on something like that before the next election, before any of them are affected by the outcome, the casting of the new maps?
Yeah, I mean, I know that's the hope, and there have been a number of groups in Wisconsin that have been working towards just that. Redistricting is one of those things that has, or redistricting reform is one of the things that does have bipartisan support. In Wisconsin, it's Democrats who largely want redistricting reform. In Illinois, where Democrats control the legislature, it's Republicans who want redistricting reform. So I think that speaks to the importance of having national standards, of having a national requirement that partisan map, or that a national requirement that state legislative and congressional maps are drawn by nonpartisan bodies.
And Brendan, does that help it stand up in court, perhaps at the U.S. Supreme Court level, if it's passed on a federal level? 30 seconds, sir.
Yeah, I think so. Like I said, the HR1 is crafted to survive Supreme Court review.
Brendan Fisher, our fine guest, thank you so much. Federal Reform Program Director, Campaign Legal Center. Say hi to your cat, man. Missed him this time.
Thanks, Brendan.
I will. Thanks for having me.
Come back with us. More Devil's Advocates. Phone lines open for you. 844-967-2789.
But if I'm right, and we can stop this thing, you will have saved the lives of millions of registered voters.